engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, or creed, or sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. In order to carry out this program, we meet twice a week. As you see, this morning we started the meeting at 11 o'clock promptly. The doors were open at 10:30. The work consists of talks and discussions on Sunday morning, and a topic from the teachings will be presented by volunteers on the platform this morning. February is the month for investigating the hidden laws of nature. This morning, February the 17th, the topic will be the potency of sound and speech. Our weekly meetings begin promptly at 7:45. You may come in at 5:30 when the doors open and spend the next couple of hours or so in the library. And when you walk in that room, you'll see shelves of various kinds of books, principally Theosophy Magazine, The Secret Doctrine, and any number of printed pages that we are the heirs to, written and kept by those long since out of this atmosphere. There's always a librarian there and other students, if this is your first visit, to familiarize you with how to proceed, either to check references, the program for that particular evening, and other straight line literature that there for anyone to investigate. Promptly, at 7:30, the library closes and you have 15 minutes before the meeting begins here at 7:45. At the present time, we're studying one of the numerous, in fact, one of the most popular documents left us by William Q. Judge. The title, interestingly enough, is called The Ocean of Theosophy. A volunteer will give a short reading, a synopsis, perhaps, of the work for that evening, and then whether you are a visitor or a regular attendee, you're welcome to either make comments, ask questions, and get an idea of how we will, over time, grasp the fundamental propositions of Theosophy, which are given out every other week from this platform. Now, in March, Wednesday the 20th, 2013, at 7:45, there will be a special meeting whereat we honor a great theosophist, William Q. Judge. There'll be a short talk on his life and what he means to every student of theosophy, no matter where in the world. recommend, if this is your first attendance, to pick up one of these little documents called a declaration, and it has several other parts to it, including the declaration, which you will find, as some of us find, food for thought. Now, as our custom is, a short reading is given before the main talk. We asked you to listen to the words, overlooking the one that presents them. This morning, as we stated, the library is a treasure chest for the teachings of theosophy, for the common man, like ourselves. And there's one little book in there you will find it. The interesting name is Light on the Path. And our reading this way, it's just a portion of the first part. And it was written for the personal use of those who are ignorant of the Eastern wisdom and who desire to enter within its influence, as we are this morning. Pay attention. Look for the flower to bloom in the silence that follows the storm, not to limp. It shall grow, it will shoot up, it will make branches and leaves and form buds while the storm continues, while the battle lasts. But not till the whole personality of the man is dissolved and melted, not until it is held by the divine fragment which has created it as a mere subject for grave experiment and experience, not until the whole nature has yielded and become subject unto its higher self, can the bloom open. Then will come a calm such as comes in a tropical country after the heavy rain, when nature works so swiftly that one may see her action. Such a calm will come to the harassed spirit, and in the deep silence, the mysterious event will occur, which will prove that the way has been found. Call it by what name you will, it is a voice that speaks where there is none to speak. It is a messenger that comes, a messenger without form or substance. Or it is the flower of the soul that has opened. It cannot be described by any metaphor, but it can be felt after, looked for, and desired, even amid the raging of the storm. The silence may last a moment of time, or it may last a thousand years, but it will end. Yet, you will carry its strength with you. Again and again, the battle must be fought and won. It is only for an interval that nature can be still. These written above are the first of the runes, which are written on the walls of the Hall of Learning. Those that ask shall have, those that desire to read shall read, those who desire to learn shall learn. Peace be with you.
Thank you. We have a most interesting topic today, and it certainly is the hope that as we begin to think about sound and speech and the potency of sound and speech together, that we'll have plenty of curiosities with which we can go off and investigate on our own to look into these hidden laws of nature. What came to mind while I was looking into the subject matter was an old riddle that our father used to perplex us with at the dinner table. He would, and I'm sure you heard about as a small child, if a tree falls in a primordial forest and there is no one there to hear it, is there still a sound? And there were many hours spent in arguing about that at our dinner table. And in, encapsulated in that childhood memory are investigative points that we can still use this morning and on into the future. Where's the difference between the abstract and the manifest, or the macro and the micro? Or what's the duality between what science would call a sound and what we would consider a subjective experience of sound? So as we think about some of these points this morning, we're asked to ponder and to consider and set up some investigative thinking of our own, if you will. When we first come to the philosophy, we're often introduced to the notion of a universal potency. And frequently when we hear about the first fundamental in classes given from this platform, we hear a phrase, abstract eternal or abstract universal motion. And we hear about the quality of being potent in latency and potential, if you will. And all of that is reflected in many, many modern religions and philosophies in which there is a notion that at the beginning of the cosmos, at the most universal manifestation we can envision with our finite minds, that there is a motion that is spirit itself, and that there's a vibration, if you will, and there's all sorts of different ways to consider that abstract motion that is forever and a causeless cause. And there's lots of terms given to it. The word, or the word was made flesh. The notion that the word precedes the dawning of light. The notion that there is logos or logoi appears in some philosophies. The transcendental causeless cause or prime mover is another consideration that occurs in many philosophies and religions. And from the viewpoint of the philosophy, from Eastern wisdom, comes the notion that there is a fullness of the seeming void, that there is a plasticity, that there is a spirit matter that fills every aspect of space as we can envision it, and that this universal principle, if you will, Akasha, has a correspondence to sound, but it is soundless. It is an abstract, amazingly ethereal vibration, where first tone, that there in this unbroken continuity of spirit and matter, an aspect of deity, if you will. And in that way, in the primordial forest, when that tree falls and there is no human being present, sound takes a different abstraction to it, doesn't it? In a certain way, sound is touch or vibration or rhythm or a cause that begins to set up effects that ripple throughout. It is in our plane, in our perception, in the human kingdom, that the periodicity and the manifestations, the effects of sound become very, very apparent. It is in our state, if you will, of periodicity of existence in which there's contrast. And throughout the philosophy, it is said that we measure our perception, we objectivize what we perceive, and that time is actually a contrast set up by sight and sound. We know from the world of science in this plane of periodicity, that as perceivers, we as humans average sound waves that we can perceive that are from 20 to 20,000 wavelengths, if you will, an expression of principles that we pick up physically through our physical ear, through our astral ear. And we know that in modern times, an awful lot of what we consider sound is lost to us. We don't perceive all the sound in this room. As thinkers, as perceivers, we tune an awful lot out. One of the funniest experiences would be being in a large classroom with overhead fluorescent lights. The elder teacher continues about his or her business. The students seated in the classroom with acute hearing can be absolutely driven crazy by the buzz of the overhead lights. The adult misses it. The younger ear picks it up. And so we know that in our modern era of the telephone and radio waves and TVs and all sorts of electronic appliances, our thoughts about sound become a bit veiled. We become very used to a mechanized scientific view of what sound is and what sound can do. We take for granted the workings of the inner ear. We take for granted the workings of the vocal cords. As long as everything's system's going and we're nice and healthy, we're perfectly happy. But here and there throughout the phenomenal world, we're beginning to see aspects of physics and metaphysics being explored. And there's a book called Hidden Messages in Water, documenting the research of a Japanese scientist, Dr. Masaru Emoto, in which water, the nature of crystallization of water, can be affected by music, by the tone of a voice, by sound in general. We know that there's lots of experiments in the world of psychology and neuroscience with the effect of music or sound on not only water, but on plants, on infants, on diseases of various kinds of the nervous system. We see all sorts of examples of the potency of sound, the effects of sound in fraternity initiations or horrible inquisitions and torture. We read of religious legends of Joshua and the Battle of Jericho and walls come tumbling down. And we know that all this occurs, but we kind of take it for granted and we move on. Sound as speech, what we're doing this morning in this morning's class, is frequently taken for granted. But we're told throughout the secret doctrine and throughout Isis that speech, the sound we produce and project for others, is the logos of our thought. That words, that the use of speech, the use of certain letters, the use of certain sounds, that creative manifestation in the human kingdom is coeval. It's coexistence with the lighting up of manas or of mind, or the birth of manas, if you will. And we see in language acquisition, if you watch the development of an infant through age 7 or so, with very gradual language acquisition and how that begins to unfold, we become more and more aware of, wow, that would be like the birth of a universe, and how sound begins to bloom and have effect throughout manifested universe. We know also as thinkers, as students of the philosophy, or frankly, as practitioners of any religious philosophy, that the earliest practice of the attempt of trying to live a higher life, a purer life, a more moral or ethical life, one of the earliest practices is control of speech, is mindful use of speech, of mindful awareness of what the potency is, never mind scientific investigations, but the very pure internal process of thinking about what is my motive of creating an idea, of sustaining the idea and giving some power to it, and then bringing that idea into sound and putting that cause out into the physical world as we know it. The process that we're using this morning, where sound is being made, a message is being attempted at being shared, and as your ear picks up the sound waves that travel throughout the medium, the fullness of the void between us, that illusion between us, being able to hear the sounds, discern the sounds, make some meaning internally, and then begin to the effort of creating organization within. The sound elicits a thought, that thought generates a lot of activity, and then we can continue to try to hold to hearing the other person. That entire process is one that appears to be very magical. It's very, very human. But if we think about what's going on in evolution in that process, we have a meeting of the physical, we have a meeting of the astral, the feeling capacity, if you will. We have a meeting of the mental. And in the motive, in the desire to comprehend, understand, and share, and raise each other up, we also have a spiritual, heartfelt overtone to the entire process of what is sound and what is speech at this particular level of existence. And so ultimately, we see a potency in sound and speech that has to do with the power of affecting results, a capacity to respond to certain influences and to begin to tap that latent power within and use it without in the world about us. And in that power, we find a creative force that is capable of procreating more and more ideation, more and more cause and effect. And in the use of right speech, the motive of right speech, to do no harm, we see a process of beginning to purify the personality, to begin to purify the motives, to begin to practice to think from a collective beneficial of good for the other, and we see the beginning of the rippling, if you will, of that return to universal soundless sound. We call that the voice of the silence, the sound of the soul, if you will, conscience, intuition, the soundless sound, and we're reminded that throughout the customs of the past in the ancient lands of Greece, where students of religious philosophy, of soul wisdom, of pure theosophy, were considered to be listeners, made no sounds, but tried to listen, to learn. They were called akustikoi, the shravaka. The learning process meant that you silenced the chatter of the monkey mind within. You silenced small talk that might disturb the pranic currents among folks. Certainly there would be no practice of gossip or slander that we see so often in our society. There would be the quieting of that Tower of Babel of many different tongues and misinterpretations. And then gradually there would be a meditative, mindful process of trying to reunite with the silent speaker within, trying to reunite with the voice of wisdom that comes within. That process of making that attempt, of trying to will ourselves to speak according to the old adage of count to 10 before you speak, of using the external vibrations that come to us through our five lenses or physical senses, and making the attempt to live in a different way. In a physical way, our senses, the parent of our senses, is the principle of desire. Living a higher, more evolutionary life to benefit, to help all of life, the parent of our inner senses becomes thought, will, and feeling. And therefore, we can use communication as a series of vibrations on a various planes, from the lowest to the highest that we can attempt. We can make translations and try to live on the highest plane that we can, trying to align ourselves with the primary forces in nature that would awaken the corresponding powers on these various planes. And so there's tremendous potency, there's tremendous power and potential in sound, no matter how we try to envision it, no matter how we try to use it. And it is up to mindful living to each of us to make every attempt to use that beneficial talent that we have, if you will, that native genius to benefit each and all. Now, I'm sure you came to the room this morning with plenty of thoughts of your own on the topic and how to investigate that. Yes, way in the back.
Is the idea that we know all the organs, the sense organs, originate in the astral. So is there a correspondence, so to speak, that when somebody becomes, say blind, when somebody becomes deaf, their other senses become heightened? So is there some kind of what happens there?
If we all proceed from this one universal source, and power is one at the loftiest level that we can imagine, then all of our senses are actually an array, a degree of attributes of the one consciousness, the one power to perceive, if you will. And it is said that when something is impaired, when hearing, if we've temporarily lost our hearing for some reason, we can find ourselves looking at somebody else's mouth while they speak, where vision becomes very, very important, because we're actually trying to lip read and trying to watch a face for contextual clues and lip read so that we can begin to understand what's being said. We have the occasion in this incarnation to know a kindergarten child who is profoundly deaf. And this earlier this week, they did a science experiment in kindergarten. She happened not to have her hearing aids in. And she got so excited because there was music involved in the lesson and the experiment. And she turned to her translator and said, "I can hear. I can hear." She was using sign language. And what the child was actually saying is that sound, the vibration, the wavelengths were coming to her through the desktop. She could feel it. That sense of sound was now a sense of touch. And frequently she can put her hand on somebody's lips so that she can feel the air and feel the vibration and begin to understand what the sound wave is, so she can learn to pronounce something. So there is interchangeability, and it's a matter of the volition of the perceiver, the acuity with which they can think, and their willful sense of attention to interchange their use of the senses to perceive and to understand. Yeah.
when the tree falls in the forest, the Akashic record of that sound and that event, is it different if there was a human being perceiving that, standing next to the tree? Is that record changed now because there's a conscious jading of that event, or is that record absolutely the same?
It would seem that the sound waves that would go out, the repercussions of the event occur and then are transmitted outward. What happens is that as perceivers working in this triumvirate, if you will, of the physical and the astral and the spiritual, the mental, we become the collectors of that transmission. And then by the use of astral, by the use of our own perception, our thought, will, and feeling, we begin to create or translate or superimpose meaning or story onto that sense perception. And therefore, each of us, the same way that we see different colors depending on our astral and physical acuity, we hear different perceptions. Those of us that have lived in apartment buildings or dormitories know that if you really want to get on under the skin of a stranger, it's music. Loud music or music that another perceiver considers irritating can drive neighbors crazy and cause a lot of trouble. So again, it's the causes are there, the Akashic record is there, the astral light is there, the vibrations are there, and as thinkers, we begin to net them, collect them, and then make meaning of them and act from that basis as though our perception is real. Yes?
In the light in the path, on the path, in the comments at the end of the book, there's a statement to the effect that one will begin to hear the inner voice once mm-hmm. one has lost the power to wound with speech.
Yes.
Along paraphrasing.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about the effects of this, our speech, not so much on, it's clear to us how our speech can wound others. You see that. How does it wound us? How does it, the way we use speech in the wrong way, set up obstacles within our own?
Well, when we create speech, it starts in the mind, doesn't it? And as soon as children have enough words where they can contain an idea, they can symbolize the idea, self-talk begins. So a tape recording infant who is being told, you're a solid thinker, wow, look what you can do, you're a sharing child, you're a kind child, those messages are being recorded and eventually become part of an inner tape. As we allow that monkey mind, that personal mind, to fly from one subject to another, as we allow negative self-talk that might have been imposed early in childhood, you know, you're a lowly sinner, or there's something bad or evil or lazy about you, all that self-talk that's internal begins to limit the perceiver and begins to twist or turn how we identify our own soul nature and how we perceive the soul nature in the world around us. As we become more and more imbued with that kind of distortion or illusion, and we create that negativity or that anger, if you will, or hurt, as that begins to emerge from us, we are affecting not only the lives in the temple of our own physical and astral body, but as we begin to transmit that in thought and word, in sounds, in presuppositions, we begin to impress all of life without us as well. And what do we know about karma? What we put out comes back. So we can limit our perception of self. We can hinder our ability to work with universal law and causation. And we can begin to negatively impress our environment. All those things are harmful. And all those things also distract us. If do an experiment as you investigate these notions this week. Those of us that are a lot older and those of us that are much younger in the room, think about music, popular music, and think about the radio. Turn the radio on to music that maybe you were aware of 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. And notice that within two or three notes of a particular melody, you may find yourself humming or singing along to words you have not heard in two, three, four, 5 years or decades. Memory can be triggered by sound. And that, I think, would give an investigatory hint about what we do with distracting us away from mindfulness, away from meditative thinking, and how we can harm ourselves. Yeah.
We were thinking we take like a silence bath when we meditate.
Yes.
We should also maybe once a day take a sound bath, some particular piece of music that moves us, that makes us feel altruistic or compassionate, or at least lifts our mind from this plane. It might be a good idea to plan that too.
It would be very good to investigate, wouldn't it? If these premises that sound is, that it permeates a plastic substance and that it is a magical key unlocking nature, if we investigate ourselves, what is it, what sound uplifts us and energizes us as spirit? What sounds might really create a downward slump in ourselves? And how the notion of bathing, of cleansing the astral and the spiritual using sight or sound, each of us is triggered by something different. We are using astral and physical substance from many incarnations past, no matter how long our incarnation has been this time. We've got habits set up, and we can use those customary if we become aware of the effects and begin to work with the nature and begin to purify or bathe the nature with that. Yeah.
In the Eastern traditions, sound is used in meditation. I mean, they have the sacred Om, and in Tibet, the monks are constantly... Chanting.
Mm-hmm. And there's another interesting study to be done. Each of the religious traditions notices that sound is sacred, and sound can be used to trigger meditative or prayerful states, or other tools. But each of them does it differently, doesn't it? In the world of Islam, the human voice is used as a call to prayer. In the Judeo-Catholic traditions in particular, Judeo-Christian in general, it's the male voice of chanting, or the cantor's voice usually. That's changing in the modern world in some sects, but not in all. The use of mantras, the use of sounds that are sacred. There's a whole study you can do, both in a series of articles in, Isis SD and some of the Theosophical articles, or even in the glossary. The letter M shows up in so many sacred ways. The legends, the multiple legends of great saviors, so many of the mothers, the names begin with an M. Maya, Mary, Miriam, Marian, various degrees of that. The letter M in terms of Mahatma, magic. It goes, just think of all the different words. So it's not only sound in general, words in particular or phrases, but it's also letters. And again, this is an intricate individual study. It's a great investigation. Yeah.
One of the questioners a minute or two ago, we think the question was related to if we hear a song, it can put us in a certain mood. If we hear this kind of a thing, it can be uplifting. That relates to the lecture in the sense of, on the one hand, it was said that desire is the parent of the senses.
The physical senses.
And then on the other hand, it was also said that thought, will, and feeling
are the parents of the inner senses, the higher senses.
Okay, so we see. So then, is it, in a certain way, in every being, is the idea to recognize that there are two parents and hopefully they're operating in harmony, or to discard one parent in favor of the other parent?
Well, you know, the modern research is that multitasking really doesn't work.
Okay.
unless you want to become addlepated. So where you focus, but an orchestra goes through that jangled moment at the beginning where they're all tuning their instruments and it sounds like this incredible discordant, what the Harrys are they doing? And then they are all lined up in a particular tonal pattern. And when they begin, everything's organized. Everything is simpatico. It's one-pointed. And you have a symphony. You have the synthesis. And that oneness, that kind of focus, we can choose, can't we? That we're going to focus on the higher, the inner use of sense, and the inner applications that will rule the outer, or we can let it go and literally slosh around. Instead of bathing, we can slosh around in the personal reactions of the lower senses. It's up to us. Yeah.
I became very intrigued with the word you used, astral acuity. Music for me has really very powerful recently in stirring up emotions. And if you could comment a little further about how vibration brings out this astral acuity and what exactly you mean by that.
We are all, as souls, as human perceivers, latently in potential, tremendous dynamos, and therefore potentially our astral powers, our soul powers, however you want to describe all of that, our mental powers, we're potentially well-rounded geniuses. We are in potential Mahatmas. But karmically, we are where we are. And depending on what we've done in many, many, many past lives, we've set up tendencies or skandhas so that we come a mixed bag. We are impotential great soul, spirit. But as egos, as souls who have taken up this physical frame and a particular mental frame and all those skandhas, we can have limited applications of power. And so there are some that would dwell on the astral, but they're dwelling on feeling of a mucky kind of nature. They'll listen to romantic music or a rock and roll music and get all imbued in pleasant or unpleasant memories of an earlier dating life or whatever. So they're actually setting up habits where they're limiting their astral acuity to things personal, things finite, self-centered, of a passionate nature. And in so doing, they're beginning to limit even further their potential for astral use. Does anybody have a different thought to answer that? Yeah.
More of an extension of that. When we think of our emotions, they're very often related to and aroused by inner images of past experiences or even present ones. and they could be traumatic or they could be present. Well, one of the interesting statements, and Judge brings this out in the ocean, that every sound creates an image in the astral. By effect, the same sound that we hear again, or music, can revivify that image or that imagination or that memory in our nature.
And it revivifies to the point where someone really can get lost. It's almost as though there's a camelopic state that is induced, and for the moment, that perceiver is not in the here and now, but can passively slip back into their perception of an earlier time and place. Yeah, way in the back.
And yet, any individual may have a connection with a piece of music that relates to a higher feeling.
Yes.
For example, when I hear Tchaikovsky, I want to go out and help save the world. It moves me to tears. And when I hear Beethoven, I'm sure I can do it. And I think it's important to realize what a particular piece of music does to you if
yes.
you're going to try to use it as a kind of medicine. There is rock and roll that is healing.
Yes.
There is romantic music that is soothing and healing. So I think we each have to find our own.
It's the onus on each of us as thinkers, isn't it, to investigate our nature as perceivers, to try to find the links between the nature of the individual human, generically, and our variation of that, and the links of that to the universals, to the collectivity. Many years ago, when we had a small number of students similar ages here, there was Theosophy School. And one of the ongoing practices was something called Fun Day Mentals instead of Fundamentals. And the kids were invited to think about the current rock music that they'd hear on the car radio in their parents' car. And the challenge was to think of some of the lyrics. They would talk about the melody or the beat, how they would, do you feel happy, do you feel sad, whatever. But they would also look at the lyrics and then try to see where those could those lyrics have a second meaning that was higher and more universal and kinder than what the general thinking singing public would think. And even 3, 4, 5 years old, far superior to the adult in the room trying to lead the conversation, these kids were really picking up on it. So it was really fundamentals for the instructor. Yeah?
It's our understanding when we think of grand opera.
A little bit louder, please.
It's our understanding that when we think of grand opera from my school days, our understanding that the chorus were minor players. They were not the important part. They only set the tone for which follows. And often we give them a principal place. And what? One begins there, and if your voice is heard, and you're conscientious, you may get a bit part in that play at first. But it's our understanding that we graduate the more in tone we are with the author's intent, and we are able to play major roles. What do we leave this earth as?
Well,
the old man at the end of the play.
We do graduate in our use of talents, and it's not just singing voices. A small child, very tiny child, may prattle on and on and on and on, making nonsense sounds or just babbling about something and just talking for the sound. Hopefully, as that child ages and becomes wiser and wiser and wiser, the graduation is an enlightened use of sound and a greater knowledge of when is silence golden, when is it important to listen, to try to understand, to hold our tongue and say nothing, and certainly not to babble and frittle away sound. But studying for the talk this morning, I came across a statement that idle talk jars pranic effects. And I had never thought of that. That's something that I'll consider and continue investigating in future weeks. Yeah.
How about talking during eating? Is that a good idea? Or
with your mouth full?
Well, sometimes. But in general, though, is it good to be meditative while eating, or does it not really? Or are there benefits to the sounds of those who you love and care about?
Wow. I didn't study along that line, but the thing that comes to mind is many, many, many religious practices not only have a morning prayer and an evening prayer, or a morning meditation where a tone for the day is set and an evening meditation where there's reflection back on the day, but many of the different efforts also have a moment of meditation or prayer, mindfulness, before a meal starts, to be very grateful for the sacrifices of the many for the nutrition about to be taken in and used by that particular organism. And certainly, as in this student's mind, our dad had a good intention of setting up discussions at the dinner table, but some of the arguments that ensued about did the tree make any sound in the forest, or, you know, what is good civil rights and what isn't, that kind of argumentation was probably not conducive to good digestion. But certainly, companionable speech during meals where there is a theosophical tone, there's an intent to maintain a peer group of like-minded individuals that they may share the philosophy that a meal is a sacrificial event. It's life physical being taken in and about to be transformed by the use of that thinker for energy to be served without. You know, that there's a hand way in the back.
Can't we say, too, in regards to impressing the food that we're taking in, if there's arguments going on, not only is it bad for your digestion, but wouldn't one be impressing, if we're talking about the power of sound, wouldn't we be impressing those lives that we're taking in?
I would guess so, sure. Yeah.
But there's a corollary with that. You can only take in and use what suits you. So if you are listening to an argument, you're not going to be imbibing it. And at the other end of that, the most important thing about a meal and its digestibility is the temperament and feeling of the one who prepared it. So you go out to a fancy restaurant, you pay $100 for a meal, the chef could have been in a very bad mood, and it's really very bad for you. So you should know more than just go to a restaurant.
What comes to mind is the adages in the Gita, where throughout Krishna is inviting Arjuna and ergo all of us to become more and more mindful, to engage in a process of perceiving and thinking about the perception, processing it, and trying to transmute it for the better. But throughout, each of us is invited to investigate, to ponder, to consider, and then to act as seems best to that thinker, to work on the intuition, the soundless sound from within, and to engage in what a friend years ago would call, you know, the art of living and the science of life. That entire process of remaining a spiritual entity as much as possible. Yes?
When the masters were asked how is it that they can find any soul, any ego in the planet and choose to either communicate with it or see it or watch it amongst billions of people on the planet, the explanation was that not only our physical body, but our astral, our mental, our Buddhic parts of our soul have a certain resonance, have a certain frequency. And each person that has a very different one. And amongst that, between five or six of those frequencies, they can actually select any person on the planet. And I can swear that when I listen to certain music, that harmonic, that those sounds made by whichever composer, perfectly, absolutely perfectly resonate with my own inherent, inborn soul resonances. And I just wanted to put that out as you just know it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if we make the effort to remain aware, and if we look into something, I hope I'm going to say it right, synesthesia, mm-hmm. The whole notion that sound, that color and sound are interchangeable, that there's one perceiver, one sense, and this is all interchangeable. This whole investigation of sound and how it's used, how we perceive, is so vital, and it's right there for us as long as we don't take it for granted. And we can learn a lot. The Chinese, there's a whole research on the great tone of nature, the kung that the Chinese talk about. And having said all that, in the key on page 65, there's a statement about deity that we could close with. Deity is eternally, incessantly evolving, not creating. Is the builder of the universe, and that universe itself is unfolding out of its own essence, not being made. We're reminded that there's an unbroken continuity of spirit and matter, and it is our continuity to engage with, engender, empower, and listen to very carefully. Have a great week.